You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Oleana, David Mamet's play about a confrontation between a middle-aged college professor and a young female student provoked controversy when it opened off-Broadway in 1992. Now, 17 years later, it's getting its first Broadway production, and it's still inspiring debates among audience members. It's on stage at the Golden Theater on West 45th Street, and I'm very pleased to welcome its complete cast, Julia Stiles and Bill Pullman, back to our show today. Hi, it's good to see you again.
Great to be here.
And Julia, weren't you in the London production of this play a few years ago opposite Aaron Eckhart?
Yeah, it was about 5 years ago in London. It was a different production. But I love the play, and it kind of stuck with me. And then Doug Hughes, our director, decided to... he was thinking about bringing it to Broadway and asked me to be a part of it because... I guess I was already familiar with the play, but we did a reading, and it reinvigorated all my interest.
Does the Broadway version feel different than the one in London, or you were in L.A. as well, weren't you, this summer?
Yeah, Bill and I took it to L.A. first before New York.
Do audiences react differently in different cities?
Yeah, I mean, the London production was a while ago. I don't really remember how people were responding, but I think there was a difference between L.A. and New York.
Although you were going to college at the time, weren't you, in London?
Yeah. So my perspective on the play has changed somewhat, too.
Bill, you've been in several Albee plays. In fact, I think you were here to talk about both of them, The Goat or Who is Sylvia, and Peter and Jerry. Is this your first experience with Mamet?
Yeah, it's my first Mamet.
Because we talked a lot about the special demands that an Albee makes. What about Mamet? He has this unique approach to speech patterns.
Yeah, I guess I'd never really thought of myself as part of that club of Mamet actors, you know, because he has selected a bunch that are continually in his plays, all good actors and very good. And I for some reason didn't think I was of that ilk. But then when this play came around, I looked at it and I thought I'd be interested in talking to Doug and see what constraints do we have. Do you have to get put through a sieve or something in order to do this work? Is there some like part of your, is there a training in some kind of jujitsu of verbosity that you got to do? Because when I read it, I heard very naturalistic sound. And, Doug talked to us both about wanting to do a play that wasn't sociology. It wasn't a thesis play, which this play had been kind of branded with that at a certain point. And that
well,
we
it's
wanna...
because people are, whether they want to or not, they wind up choosing sides. It forces you to think about all sorts of issues that are pretty much in the world today. So, I mean, that's why it can be done
yeah.
as a thesis play.
That's a little bit of misdirection, I think, you know, in that it can feel like you got to take sides. But as Mamet had on kind of a byline, no matter which side you're on, you're wrong.
But his dialogue always seems to be tough to learn, or at least it strikes me to be tough to learn. There are all these stops and starts. People are constantly interrupting each other. Julia, and you've done that with a whole bunch of different actors over the years because you've been in other Mamet things and you've been in this play before. Is it hard to learn?
But it just takes repetition. And the best part is once there was a moment, I think, in L.A. or even in rehearsals where we I think Bill and I got to the point where we realized, like, if one of us jumps a line or if we talk over each other, we've repeated these words so many times that we wouldn't get totally lost.
Julia is a star pupil, and I am not. So I still am working to make sure it's every word is in there. And now I'm down to this thing about that. And I've got about 12 that's in sentences. You know, I know that that's true, right? Rather than I know that's true. You know, I asked the assistant stage manager to give me line notes every week at the end of the week to see where I've done things wrong. And the that's are killing me this week.
But the precision
the audience
of the
doesn't
language,
notice.
The precision of the language is so great, and I think that's what makes us want to get the lines right, is that every single word is deliberate, and the turns of phrase and the reasons that people, that these characters self-edit or interrupt each other or cut each other off, or the single word that can trigger a response, that it's so... It's almost written like a musical score, and I feel like we want to be respectful of that.
Well, Mamet is famous for saying there is no character, just lines on a page. I've heard other playwrights describe that way. Many people have told me that the way to play Shakespeare is simply to trust in the words.
Yeah, and Edward's quite a bit like that, you know, and definitely... you know, we let our playwrights have their egotism, I guess.
No. You know, and he writes that, but I obviously that's somewhat to be taken with a grain of salt. But he writes in this play, like at the end of Act One, the professor is saying, "Shh, shh, let it go, it's all right." I mean, and it's the implication is, I think that my character is having some sort of emotional problem, maybe whether she's crying or whatever. He doesn't write that in the stage direction, but what else could the professor be talking about? So, you know, Mamet also finds a way to kind of write you into a corner.
Are either of you willing to give us the basic outline of the plot without giving too much away?
Julia's very good. Oh, okay.
Well, I mean, yeah, it has been branded as this, as being about, I guess, sexual harassment because it's a student who files a complaint against her teacher who's up for tenure. But the complaint is about so much more than that. And I really like the way that in our production, we haven't focused just on one incident that happens. It's really a dialogue about you know, the language that the professor uses and the maybe way that he can be condescending. Or it's hard for me to talk about it without talking from my character's perspective. But you know, and it's largely a play about power and how somebody who has felt betrayed tries to, in an effort to make the person in power understand what that feels like, usurps power and kind of throws it back into his face.
Could you have played this any other way but through understanding your character's perspective? I mean, I've always wondered about playing villains because there are some people who feel that Carol is the villain of this piece.
Well, it's interesting that you ask that because I don't know who said it, but I've heard somewhere somebody said that the villain is the hero of his own story. And, you know, from Carol's perspective, she's not villainous. So I have to think of it that way.
Now, you worked with Mamet early in State in Maine as well. Mm-hmm. A very different kind of character. Although
it was a comedy, and he was a film that he wrote and directed.
Did you talk to him about this production?
He stayed out of our rehearsal period because I think he wanted to let us do our own thing. But he did come to the opening in L.A. With Rebecca Pidgeon, who played my character in the original Off-Broadway production. His wife. And they were very complimentary, you know. They were very enthusiastic. So I think he kind of embraced our approach.
My guests are Julia Stiles and Bill Pullman, the cast of Oleana, now at the Golden Theater on West 45th Street, a revival of David Mamet's play, a play that I would assume gets revived a lot and, as time goes on, changes a lot. I probably 17 years ago was a different world, and people saw the play a little differently, don't you think?
Yeah.
I mean, that was before David Letterman. That was before I'm not even sure whether there was Bill Clinton had yet been involved with Monica Lewinsky.
Yeah, I guess it was 92. There was the Clarence Thomas, mm-hmm, Nita Hill thing that happened at the time, but people sometimes can get confused and think that he wrote it in response to that, but he didn't. But I think that chance, yeah, now that there's an interesting phenomenon of the phone in the play. And I can't help but think it works better now than ever.
Because of cell phones.
And the play is built with my characters constantly in contact with his wife and and his lawyer, who are, never seen. And the kind of intrusion on his psyche is so much more potent now because we're all carrying phones that are buzzing or tweaking or lighting up or whatever. And that kind of possibility of letting an intrusion slip into a conversation or into a moment is much more feasible now than it was in 92.
And we do feel the different things pulling on him. He's trying to deal with the student. At the same time, the phone keeps on ringing, and he has to deal with other issues, big issues in his life.
Yeah.
But there's also a subtle, not to sound too much like Carol, but there is a subtle message. I know it's generally acceptable to answer a phone, you know, and people have obligations, but there is a subtle message when you're in the middle of a conversation, you answer a phone or, you know, your cell phone's vibrating or you send a text message. It's that that conversation is more important than the one that you're having.
It's true. And we will often say, you know, I'll let them leave me a message on voicemail. I'll get back to them later.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking about the play with a college professor recently. He said he would never talk to a student. I mean, he's been teaching for a long time, and times have changed. Now he would never speak to a student with the door of his office closed. And although he's the sort of person who often throws his arm around someone's shoulder, he's trained himself not to do that with his students. When this play was written, that probably was not one of the I don't even know if those are written rules anymore in universities, but definitely was not one of the unwritten rules.
Yeah, I think universities have policies in place now. At Columbia, where I went, there was a whole policy that everyone was educated on, and you leave the door open. And there was a way to, if you wanted to file a complaint, there was a whole procedure, which are steps that have been taken since 1992.
Speaking about the phones, there's a particular moment when Carol's about to reveal something very personal, and his phone rings. And I wonder if that was a turning point for her.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. For a number of reasons, her own, what's going on inside her head and her own emotions, but also the sense of betrayal, and then also probably shame about, you know, being embarrassed about opening up to somebody else, and then they basically are dismissive of you.
Mm-hmm. Did you talk about the character's motivations during rehearsals? Because that's something Mamet also seems to discourage, at least when he's talking to people like me.
Mm. We did, yeah. In L.A., we didn't really talk to each other about it, but Doug talked to each of us separately. And then here in New York, we kind of more brought it all together, I think. And, it always amazes me when, there's a professor who said he never would have closed his door. And people like to think, oh, God, he was so stupid when he did, you know, and you think, well, you know, what about that agreement with Shylock and Merchant of Venice? Do you think, oh, he was so stupid that he would allow that to be the penalty? You know, mm-hmm. I would have known not to do it. I mean,
a pound of flesh, you can't ask for that.
Can't ask for that. I would have known never to do that. And no matter what, how unlikely it would be to pay it back, I never would have done it. You know, and if that's what plays are, I don't know. If we're theaters,
then it would be so boring to watch everybody behave perfectly on stage.
Yeah, this is a Friday afternoon in a university where he's got an appointment that he's late for. Things are in flux in this real estate deal. This is a student who he's seen in class who has been hostile from word go, and this is our assumption, and I think it's true. And then she's there in the class, and there is a kind of pushback that they both get engaged with each other quicker than maybe in that circumstance, you know, something happens. And I taught before, and I was aware, this was even before a lot of this awareness go on, but, you know, you're aware of all that stuff, but laws and codes of behavior are all beautiful, but there's circumstances in which sometimes those are trying.
But it's also a play about power and inequity. He is a professor. He has the power to ruin his student's life by giving her a failing grade, and she doesn't have all that much power of her own, although in this play she winds up being able to use a charge of sexual harassment to counter his power over her.
Yeah, and it's not just a complaint about sexual harassment. That's the thing that is the most charged and ends up fueling the rest of the play. But there is a complaint about he's up for tenure and his whole lecture, he makes the students buy his book, which is all about how education is failing the young and that it's just virtual warehousing, and that he tells her that, you know, grades are nonsense and it's about regurgitating misinformation, which is a fun, interesting idea. But at the same time, from her perspective, she's paying lots of money to go to a school to be taught that it's worthless.
He's trying to be one of the guys, actually, trying to show them that he really understands where they're coming from, and he's misunderstanding totally where a lot of the students are coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I beg to disagree. No, differ. But I think that, there is an incredible brilliance to saying, You know, if you're in a hysterical place about you can't learn anything, then drastic measures have to be taken. And you have to be ready to say, what is the essence of your learning? It's a very simple thing. And this is not just about getting a grade. This is about you making a jump right now that could be really important to lifelong learning. And sure, maybe that's dangerous in the university now. And then I wonder, you know, really whether it's universities are doing their full job unless they do that kind of thing.
Well, and she actually is the ultimate good student. I mean, she ends up learning that lesson to the you know, extremely and exposing it, you know.
Yeah, right. A law professor called in and said that his school has an open door policy, but the fire department confiscated the door stoppers because they were a fire hazard. Wait, after the play, at least when I went, there was a discussion, and we'll take a little break and we'll come back to what people are saying, what people in the audiences are saying. My guests are Bill Pullman and Julia Stiles, the cast of Oleana, now at the Golden Theater on West 45th Street. Stay with us for more. We're back with Julia Stiles and Bill Pullman, the full cast. I don't know why I want to say that, but because I guess they fill the stage, a big Broadway stage, and you never feel like you needed anybody else out there. In a revival of David Mamet's play, Oleana, which was originally produced off-Broadway. And I was thinking a bit about how things have changed. Some reviewers feel that William H. Macy in the original production portrayed John as a more pompous and arrogant man, and that you've made him more sympathetic. Was that a conscious choice, or was that just the way you read the lines?
No, that was a conscious choice with Doug. You know,
Doug Hughes, the director,
and you know, it was shared with kind of how we approached it with Julia too, which was, all of us have incredible respect for this play, and we felt like there was a very personal side to it, that there was a lot of things that were in play that were beyond just disagreements, and for me, they were beyond power. Because there's some kinds of ways in which it becomes a dialectic between somebody who believes in reason, ultimately, as a way to find a way through. If there's been a sense of betrayal on somebody's part or both parts, then how do you find some consensus? You look to be reasonable.
But you're talking in defense of your character.
Right.
And in the same way that Julia was talking as Carol.
Yeah, and so that part of the clarity of that was why I think we chose to make those issues of John become very clear, so that it doesn't become like, oh, he's a creepy guy.
He seems to be kindly but distracted.
His failures come from other reasons. Yeah, yeah. And there is just this relentless thing. And then, you know, the idea is that you can see what it is that he is aspiring to that is good, and then what he fails, that he predicts his own failure. Like in a tragedy, usually there is that kind of arc, and I think there is that kind of tragic arc in it.
Julia, in some productions, Carol has been portrayed as crazy, and others cold and calculating, and in the film version, where she was played by Deborah Eisenstadt, opposite Bill Macy, her character seems softer and his tougher. Mm-hmm. Have you seen other productions? Did you see the
film? I did see the movie, yeah. I just think, you know, but I haven't seen it recently because I didn't really want it to influence my performance. But, I think what we really tried to do is steer away from playing archetypes. I mean, because the play is so politicized and people go into it with this expectation that it's he said, she said, or that they have to choose a side, you know, it would be kind of boring to see him be stereotypical, like a lechy professor, and for her to be this cold, you know, militant feminist or whatever.
Although she does talk about our group, and it seems to at a time like she is also being pushed to take certain positions by a feminist group.
Well, you know, he never actually says the word feminist in the play. I mean, she just says my group, and people kind of come up with their own idea of what the group is all about. But I liken it to, you know, the one of the points in the play is that it's very dangerous to justify your own position because you have the support of a number of people. So, you know, the group could even be like friends of hers that are saying, "Oh, he did that. That's horrible. That's wrong. You've got to nail him for it." You know, but the professor is propped up by the institution in the beginning, and she's propped up by her group later. But you know, it's to a certain extent, she's very impressionable too. So once she's finally told that her voice and her opinion is valid, you know, that empowers her to push even harder.
Do you you have to believe that as the person playing the role, that Carol is right in making these charges?
Well, you know, I think the play goes through lots of turns. So there are, yes, I do have to be convincing in my argument, but I think it's also, it goes beyond just the words and the sort of intellectual argument. I think, you know, there's a lot of emotion there, you know, whether it's, there was something that Bill talked about a lot in rehearsals that really stuck with me, which is the idea that people walk around sort of swallowing a lot of their anger, and she's somebody who really lets it out.
Now, the night I went, there was a talk back. Is that continuing throughout the run of the play?
No.
Oh, it was called Take a Side. So even though you're saying we shouldn't do that, that's what the talk back was being called. And after preview performances, guest speakers, including Montel Williams, David Dinkins, Catherine Irby of Law and Order, Tovah Feldshuh, and others were also invited to talk. Did either of you take part in them?
No.
After a performance, I'd imagine the both of you are rather drained.
Well, and also, like, I think a lot of it was great that a lot of the audience wanted to stay and they felt compelled to speak. But I feel like in L.A. we would participate in a couple of those talkbacks. And then it became about us having to answer for the play, you know, and we know a lot of times people would come in very angry and almost projecting their own experience onto this play, and we would have to be responsible for it.
Well, on the night I was there, some people felt that David Mamet had stacked the deck against Carol because from what they saw on the stage, her accusations are a total misread of John's intentions.
Yeah, the responses that I get are pretty amazing. I mean, I sort of feel like, to a certain extent, that's the point of the play, because what happens at the end forces people to kind of question their own biases or their own hatred towards this girl. But I've had people say to me outside the stage door, "I would have killed you. He should have killed you." Things like that, you know. And it's extreme, but
that's horrifying. That's just exacerbating the situation of the play.
Well, and in no like polite conversation would anybody say, "Oh, you know, this girl deserved it," or that they wanted her to be beaten up or whatever.
No, she's not a bad person.
And the other, we were talking about Shakespeare a second ago. I felt like, well, Bill might disagree, but
no. Well, that's okay.
But you know,
I see the play also through a generational thing. So I mean, the questions are, why do they keep coming back to each other? You know, and those are, you can either say, oh, that's not logical, or that's not the law, or somebody wiser would blah, blah, blah. But they're compelled into each other. They're thrown into each other. And there is some extraordinary thing about how they fuel each other. And in some ways, here's a curious sidebar. And I don't know if it's been talked about or we should, but Mamet was going through a separation and then divorce during this play, and there is an incredible sense of betrayal on both sides, and there is this sense that she has of saying, listen, you want it both ways. You want to have a nice house, and you want to have a job, and then you want to go outside and make your own rules. And that is Mamet at his best, I think. You know, that's when – so people say, well, he stacked the deck and everything else, but he does put the finger on John as – this kind of thing that really is a difficult thing for anybody to balance, and it can be your downfall.
Well, some people have seen an unspoken sexual attraction between the two, although it's never stated.
Yeah, and it's not in that moment of touch. It's from something else. In the moment of touch, I mean, when I say, you know, hey, I touched you, it was devoid of sexual content. She doesn't say, you're a liar. She says, that's not for you to say. That's for me to say. So, you know, I think there is this incredible engagement and chemistry and friction they have with each other.
You mentioned generational divide, and I went with somebody who went to school in the past. And she said, things were a lot worse with the professors in the old days. They actually were coming on to us. But we understood. We understood the deal. And we took care of them. We handled it.
And Carol is unwilling to do that, which I think is a kind of positive side of her character.
Well, things have changed.
Yeah.
In those days, you just had to grin and bear it and find ways to elude the grasp of the grasping professor. But today, the rules have changed a lot. One question asked the night I went was, do you think this play could have been done with reverse casting, a female professor and a younger male student? What do you think?
I know David has an interest in kind of like twerking things around. And in L.A., there was a controversy because when they came to L.A. in 92, he wanted to do it with a black professor and a white student. And that was right during the riots. And that was not allowed at the Taper. They did it at the Tiffany that way. But I don't know whether he probably might find there's an other levels of complication that might not be served by that, but it would be interesting to me.
What do you think?
I think there would be that would muddy it or confuse the issue. Because there is so much going on in the play, but there is a fundamental thing, and I can't quite put my finger on it about men and women in the play. That I think that's partially what riles the audience up. That if you reversed it, it might dilute the whole thing.
And I have a feeling that if there were a racial component, that would just complicate the situation so much that much of the subtlety would be lost, don't you think?
Yeah, it would be. It might be interesting to have the student be a black female student, but I don't know. I mean, then again, with the men and women thing, there's the power in the play is defined many different ways. It's power at the institution, at the university, grading, all that, and then there's intellectual power, and then there's physical power too. So I think that to have a female professor would confuse it.
Do you try to be as consistent as possible? Because I've spoken to actors who say that they like things changing every night, and other actors who say they hate things changing every night. As you've developed these roles, have you gone back and forth? Sometimes play John a bit tougher, a bit more gentle, and the same with Carol?
I notice differences in Bill's performance every night. And I would like to think that I do it differently every night, but I don't know how much of that is really expressed. It might just be what's going on in my own head.
You do.
But yeah, I mean, and they'll be really nice. What the most exciting moments, I think, are when surprises happen, even if they're accidents or mistakes, or if it's an audience reaction or some new emotion that has surfaced. But all of a sudden, that kind of locks us into really paying attention to each other and listening and responding and being present.
You say audience reaction. Audiences, you can hear the gasps.
Oh, you can hear everything. I can hear everything.
Mm. And I think I asked you earlier whether it was different in L.A. or is this pretty much the same sort of thing wherever you would play it in the United States?
Well, we're really enjoying the stakes in New York. You know, I think it's there's incredible focus on the stage. It's a proscenium and it's more contained, so we're really finding that to be useful. But I think there is something about how smart they are in New York. You feel a certain kind of intelligence with certain kinds of responses, and then that ups your game. You know, and I think it does change the thinking. I think, sometimes this is a play that I believe is very much a live score. And I always was really excited to do it with Julia because right from the first I felt like we would always be talking to each other up there and not just declaiming. And so we've gone that direction, and there is a flux in it. And I don't think it wounds the play or the meaning of the play or anything. It just makes people think they're at an authentic event.
The reason I ask is I also wonder whether it would be different if it were being played in Madison, Wisconsin, or Amherst, college towns where pretty much the college dominates the town, and this kind of thing would be the topic of discussion every day.
Yeah, though here they have HR, right? And there's corporate things with human resources, and that's quite a bit like colleges now, in terms of finding all that. But there is a way in which, too, I think now the play has they say, well, everybody was so aware of sexual harassment and all that stuff then, and it's kind of we're all integrated in that now. But I think now the danger of being accused of something and having that stick with you, you were talking about an incident in which that was true, is much more common now than then. That you could maybe be brought up against charges, but people would bury it or they would deal with it in different ways. And now even any accusation lives with your record. So it's more potent, I think, in some ways now than it was then.
The idea that an accusation like that could stick with you is definitely
well. We're seeing it right now with stories from clergy, for example. Just one broke recently last week in the New York Times. These things were handled differently in the past.
Yes, mm-hmm. But I was just reading. Naomi Wolf wrote this article in New York Magazine. I think it was like 5 years ago, and it was. And I was rereading it because I remember I'd never really actually read it myself, and I kept thinking, well, why did she had a professor at Yale that came on to her, and she kept quiet about it, and then 20 years later, she wrote an article for New York Magazine about it, and I read it again last night, thinking, well, yeah, why did she bring it up again? And her whole point was, some universities actually don't have policies in place, and there are a lot of women that go around swallowing it and keeping quiet because they're worried about being humiliated, and they still, you know, don't want to be they don't want to have their reputation sullied as much as a professor might.
Now, neither character is named Oleana. Do you know where the title comes from?
It was a utopian community that was in the 1800s. Ole Bull, a Norwegian guy, and his partner Anna. And so they made the name Oleana is the name of this, and it failed, but it was and ridiculed as, like, how could they believe they were going to live in such an idealized world? And I think Mamet uses it as an ideal world.
Because academia, in theory, is an ideal world, but in reality it's a world of humans.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
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 Was that your—well, you went to Columbia, but you were also working— all the time, weren't you, Julia?
So, I took a couple semesters off to work, but when I was in school, I was totally focused on school.
Uh-huh. Is it different if you're going to a school in, like Columbia, which is the middle of New York?
Yeah, I didn't get the sense that we were isolated or in an ivory tower, because a lot of our classes incorporated the city. So we would, if we were taking art history, we would go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art. So and I think their approach was, although very classical. With the core curriculum, they also wanted us to have a perspective of, you know, of being relating what we were learning, even if it was a classical education, to current events and the world around us.
In the early years of film, actors went back and forth between the stage and film work. That stopped happening largely. There were always some who did, but now we're seeing it again. Is this, do you think, the way things are going to be from now on? Actors doing a film and then going back to the stage and then doing another film?
I think there are a lot of actors who are in this climate, you know, who are trained in theater and have chops in it. In this climate where there's less and less films being made and the television thing becomes a long-term obligation, that theater is a great option.
Unless you're doing Law and Order once in a while as a drop-in.
Yeah, that's...
But, and is that the case for you too, Julia? I mean, are there fewer film roles available to you? Is that the reason you're doing theater?
Well, it's not the reason that I'm doing theater, because I truly love this, and it's like such a blessing to go to work every day and feel like you're doing what you absolutely love to do. And there's such a immediacy with theater and a feeling of... I mean, there's so many things that I love about doing a play, especially this play, that's really the reason. But I do sense that there are fewer opportunities and there are fewer films being made just because the industry, the business is changing.
One thing actors have told me is that in film, you get a few takes and then that's it forever. In theater, every night you get an opportunity to rethink the role and to improve on it. Some actors have told me that if you really want to see the play done well, you should see it fairly late in the run when everybody has really worked through their characters. You're nodding your head, Bill.
Yeah, sometimes they can go south, I guess. But
you can get bored with it too at a certain point,
can't
you?
Certain people or certain plays, you know, I feel very lucky to have a text like this. And with Edward's plays, I felt just so engaged by it and humbled by them, you know, and so to have this chance to repeat it, many people don't understand that. They think, how do you just want to do it over and over again? Now you got to go again. And it's impossible to explain how beautiful it is when you're in the moment and things are moving and shaking in a different way than it ever had before. And you don't, you're riding it like you're riding this kind of gust of wind. And it's worth the sacrifice that we all make, you know, to do it.
You mean the financial sacrifice?
Well,
and the time?
And time, you know, I mean, this has been our year's work. Because we did it in L.A., and then there was a break, and then there was here, and this is our work for the year. And I'm in L.A., I have family in L.A., they're there, and so they're coming back and forth, and but it works out, and it's worthwhile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's a kind of, I guess, you know, there are a lot of benefits to doing a film, but it's so herky-jerky. There's a lot of waiting around, and you just do one scene here and there, and you don't really feel like you don't get that kind of sense of being lost in the material and or a lack of self-consciousness and also like it might be repetitive nightly doing a play, but it's also it just gets deeper and deeper and to the point where you're not you can kind of as soon as the play starts, especially this play, I think, because it's so quick and there's no time to sit back and second guess anything or take a break in your dressing room, the play kind of takes on a life of its own, and it's really thrilling.
In fact, they're just brief scene changes where you change your clothes.
Yeah.
And then you get right back into it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming by here. Bill Pullman, Julia Stiles, Oleana, David Mamet's play, now at the Golden Theater, directed by Doug Hughes, who has another hit play on Broadway as well. Is this an open run?
Yep.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, good luck to you. I hope you're here for a long time. Come back when you're completing the run.
Okay.
We can talk about how things have changed for you.
Absolutely.
Great. Oh, that'd be great.
Thanks.
Thanks.